Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, national champions, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And now, here is your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, videos, and other things at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me, Melody Lauer.
Hello.
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 Hey, we're in studio again, recording more stuff.
Indeed.
Are we? No, we're already back from SHOT Show.
I was going to say, is this
incredible.
Post-SHOT?
Yeah.
And it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I'm totally, I'm not sick. I'm sure I've got all sorts of new sponsors to announce soon. And yeah, it was great. So look at me being optimistic. That is not like me. Hey, guess what?
What is that?
This segment brought to you by Lucky Gunner and Federal Premium Ammunition. Whether there was a firefight or you do, in fact, want to worry about that little guy, you need more ammo. And when it's time to restock, you can't beat Federal Premium Ammunition and LuckyGunner.com. With a shipping department that's always moving at 88 miles per hour, if I order a case of American Eagle from Lucky Gunner on a Thursday, it's at my doorstep ready to shoot before the weekend starts. Head to LuckyGunner.com today to check out their in-stock lineup of Federal Premium Ammunition. And remember, unless you're on fire or drowning, you can never really have too much ammo. So I am very, very excited and very, very pleased to welcome back to the show one of my mentors, a man who has done an incredible amount of things for me, Mr. Tom Givens. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, certainly can't complain, sir. Thank you again very much for taking time out of your day to talk to us. I know you're a busy man, and I and the listeners really appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here.
So for those that don't know, and if you don't know, you really should fix yourself right now. But for those that don't know, who are you and what do you do? And we'll hop right in.
Well, right now I'm a full-time firearms trainer. I've been a full-time trainer since 1996. I guess that's 22 years now. Before that, spent 25 years in law enforcement jobs of one kind or another, including training other people. Used to shoot the IPSC competition way back in the day, involved in setting up IDPA, won a couple of state and regional championships in that, and been around the training scene now for well over 40 years, and just that's what I do. It's my thing.
Nice. Well, kind of what I wanted to talk to you about today was sort of because you have been doing this at a very high level for a very long time. And things have, I assume things have changed quite a bit from when you started to when, where we are today. And I was curious to get sort of your perspective on that and sort of hop into it. I mean, for the civilian context, I think what a lot of people don't realize is, you know, back 20, 30 years ago, how rare, civilian carry was, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Things have changed greatly during the time that I've been involved in this. And as you said, part of it is just the proliferation of private citizens being able to carry. When I first started teaching people professionally in 1975, did it on a part-time basis from then until 96 and then full-time since then. If you go back and look at, say, around 1985, there were only about 11 or 12 states in the country that had a permit system. In most of the rest of the country, it was not legal for a private citizen to carry a pistol concealed. There were some states, particularly in the West, where open carry was legal for anybody. But in the eastern half of the country, that was typically not the case. So there weren't very many private citizen gun carriers back in those days. When I first started teaching in 75, we were mostly teaching police and armed security personnel. And you had some civilians that came in for training, but it was, you know, geared toward defending their home more than anything else or the business. They weren't able to carry away from those places.
Right.
We had a huge increase in violent crime in the 70s, early 80s, and really, I think, got people stirred up. And Florida became the first shall issue state about 1987. And their statute worked very well. Within a very short period of time, they had quite a few people with permits and a very small amount of problems with them, statistically far less than with police officers. So a lot of other states kind of emulated Florida's lead in that. So now we've got a completely different situation than we had 30 years ago.
Right.
Now all 50 states have at least a theoretical way to get a permit to carry a gun. And of course, there are a few holdout states like Hawaii that you're still not going to get one, even though there's a legal way to do so. Unless you're politically connected, you're still not going to get one.
Right.
But that's an exception. Actually, I was looking at last night, we got 13 states now that have constitutional carry, as it's often called, where you carry without a permit, carry concealed without a permit, which would have been unheard of 35 years ago.
Well,
there are 28 shall issue states. There are really only 9 may issue states left where it's discretionary. So really 41 of the 50 states have a mechanism that without having to argue about need or whatever, private citizen can carry a gun.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, so, and I don't want to get too far down the political rabbit trail because I absolutely hate talking about it, but would you have ever thought that national reciprocity was a thing that might even happen, 30 years ago? I mean, was that?
Oh, no.
Not
at all. Carrying a gun wasn't recognized in the mainstream consciousness as something that was desirable in those days. I think attitudes toward it have changed drastically. Like in my state here in Florida, for instance, we got about 1 million permit holders now.
Right.
In a state of 14 million people, that indicates a pretty high level of public acceptance. There are a couple of cities I can think of, Memphis, Birmingham, both, for instance, where over 10% of the population has a carry permit.
Mm-hmm.
That would not be imaginable 35 years ago. I think public perception has changed a lot.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what do you think has sort of spurred that?
Well, I think the combination of a continuing violent crime and a more public awareness of it now, with all the instant access to media and all the social media, I think people are probably more aware of violent crime than they were in the past. In the past, if you were in the business, you were aware of it. But if you weren't in the business, you typically really didn't realize the level of violent crime. But now you see examples of it day in and day out. I mean, how many times a day in your news feed on your phone do you get a story about an abduction, murder, home invasion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? It just goes on constantly.
Yeah.
So I think that's a difference. One thing I would point out is more intelligent than educated people tend to get permits to carry. As you know, I ran a fixed facility school for 18 years in Memphis.
Right.
And we trained, I think, 46,000 people for permits, which requires an 8-hour class in Tennessee. And quite a few, about 43% of those went on to further training after that. But still, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And we tracked the demographics on them pretty well. They filled out a little form when they came in for class. They had little information on it that we actually tracked. And we found that the majority of people that came in for permit class were in some form of medical profession. They were either doctors or nurses, technicians of some kind.
Right.
Attorneys, sales professionals, management, and people who own small businesses. And only about 7% were in jobs that you could identify as blue collar. So I think people, as I said, are more aware now, and they're aware that they have options. And I think they're taking advantage of it. According to the best estimate I've seen recently, there's about 15 million people in the country now with a carry permit of some sort. And then plus the states where you don't need one. So pretty significant piece of the population carrying now.
Huh. So his – I guess how – so we've kind of sort of talked about like the number of people carrying and where they're carrying at and sort of like how they could do that. But like has what they – what the private citizen carries these days, has that changed over the last the last 30, 35 years in your estimate, or – how has that sort of evolved?
Yeah, that's a huge change. A lot of the younger guys in your audience probably don't even realize the vast array of choices they have today just didn't exist 30 years ago. We kind of take for granted. You know, we got a huge number of really high-quality choices for carry guns now. It's not just one or two. And that wasn't the case back in the day. When I first started training, just about everybody was carrying a K-frame Smith & Wesson revolver if they were in law enforcement or security on duty. And then we're carrying a J-frame or maybe a 2-inch K-frame or a Colt D-frame off-duty or as a backup gun.
Right.
And that's about it. And the only autos we had access to in those days was either 1911 or a Browning High Power. And in classes I taught and that I attended, you'd see maybe one High Power in I don't know, a couple hundred people, and the rest would be 1911s. For instance, when I went through the 499 class at Gunsight in 1980, and that was the highest class they taught at that time. And I think there were 20 people in my class, and it was 100% 1911. There was nothing else in my class but that.
Well, let me interrupt right there, Tom.
Let me finish that thought, though. Last year, we taught two classes in Texas with zero 1911s in them, none.
Huh.
That's a pretty big change.
No, that is, and I want to talk about that a little bit more. We have to go to break. Right now, we're talking with Tom Givens from Rangemaster. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s and scatterguns since 1977, a legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories, as well as the new EDC X9, which offers discriminating shooters 1911 match-grade accuracy, superior ergonomics, and concealability, with modern service pistol capacity and reliability at www.wilsoncombat.com. And I will tell you right now, there is not a worse feeling in the world than interrupting Tom Givens, because then, like, when you said, let me finish that thought, I'm like, yes, sir, I'm so sorry. But
are you taken to the principal's office?
No, it's just like, oh, I don't want to do this, but I have to. It's like, okay. But
it's all right. It's all right, Don.
Yeah, I know. What's funny, though, and you were saying that, you know, so going from 1980 at Gunsight, where the only option amongst serious individuals is essentially a 1911, probably that's had work done on it. To fast forward, and you teach a class in Texas, and there are no 1911s, period.
Yeah, we've actually seen that a number of times in the last year with class with 15, 20 people in and not a single 1911. And that's just a huge change from back in the day.
Well, and I think people don't really understand, too, that, you know, up until, you know, probably 20 years ago, 25, a reliable magazine was not a thing that you could necessarily go out and get, you know?
Oh, yeah. That you got Wilson and McCormick magazines now. And back in the bad old days, all we had were GI surplus magazines, which are pretty soft and really didn't hold up well to extended use.
Right, right.
And the new magazines are just much more reliable as well. A lot of times reliability problems with the auto are not the auto. It's just crappy magazines.
Right. Do you think that, you know, what has become more prevalent in your experience, as far as there one platform that sticks out to you, or?
Well, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years, we've seen more Glocks than pretty much anything else. But again, a lot of the new kids on the block don't realize Glocks didn't come around until 1986.
Yeah.
And it took a few years to get a little bit of traction. SIG started bringing guns into the country in the 1980s. Of course, the M&Ps, HKs came along much later. We're seeing, you see a fair smattering of M&Ps and HKs in classes now. I'd say Glock's still probably the majority, but not by the huge margin it was, say, 5 years ago.
Right.
But mostly what we're seeing nowadays, of course, are modern polymer frame striker fired pistols of some variety, whether it's an M&P, H&K, or a Glock.
Yeah. Do you think some of the advancements in technology have sort of ushered along those changes in what people are deciding to carry for personal protection?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The modern guns are so much less labor-intensive on the part of the operator, less maintenance-sensitive, and don't require a bit of training as an armorer like a 1911 does if you're going to seriously carry one. You have to remember the design phase for the 1911 was 1903 to 1911,
right.
Over 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And automation was rare and expensive, but skilled hand labor was cheap and plentiful. And
right.
Now we have the exact opposite. Now skilled hand labor is rare and expensive, and automation's cheap and plentiful.
Right.
The design just doesn't lend itself to modern manufacturing methods. It still needs to be hand-fitted. And if you're going to carry one, bet your life on it, you've almost got to be a qualified armorer. You want to keep up with spring changes and extractor tension. And it requires more attention. You take a modern striker fired gun, clean it now and then, and pretty much forget about it.
Right. Right. Well, and even the decision as far as, like, I know one of the things that everybody wants to talk about is, you know, what caliber should I carry and things like that. And even that decision has changed quite a bit from 1975 to 1990 to today.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. That's another night and day change. In 75, the ammo we had was nowhere near as effective as the stuff we have today. In 38 Special, which was the most common defensive caliber in those days, they were still tons of police departments issuing 158 grain round nose lead. That was still mandated round in a whole lot of the country, and it's long had a reputation for being a very poor performer.
Right.
We didn't get the first generation of jacketed hollow point stuff, supposedly high performance stuff like Silvertip and Supervel, till the late 70s, early 80s, and it frankly didn't work anywhere near as well as the stuff we have today. Everybody knows about the 1986 FBI experience in Miami that led to their reexamination of ammunition. But one of the things the FBI did was held two of what they called wound ballistics workshops at Quantico, where they brought in actual from around the country, went outside their own agency and brought in a lot of outside people like Dr. Martin Fackler and Dr. Carol Peters. Peters was a very busy medical examiner and a ballistic researcher, and Fackler was head of the Army Wound Ballistics Lab, and brought in some other people like that, including people with some extensive experience shooting people, and came up with the protocols they're still used today in testing ammunition, and that brought about some real changes. The ammunition manufacturers at that time were selling the basic ball ammo faster than they could make it. They had no real incentive to do any R&D work, which is expensive.
Yeah.
And come out with stuff that actually works because they were selling everything they could make. But when the federal government basically said, you're going to have to improve this stuff or we'll find somebody else to make it for us, they actually got on board, and we got the current stuff that we rely on nowadays. It's just a completely different performer. You know, the HST, Gold Dot, rounds with Barnes, copper bullets, those are just nothing like the crap we had in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
You know, in those days, you had the choice basically of 38 round nose lead or 9mm ball or 45 ball. So there was a obvious discernible difference in performance between the big caliber and the smaller calibers. With modern ammunition, that gap exists, but it's a hell of a lot smaller than it was in those days.
Well, and a lot of people too, and something that's always been very impressive about you to me, and there's several things, but the one that has always struck me the most is your willingness to examine new data as it becomes available, which, frankly, a lot of people, once they have really well established themselves, sort of, it seems like they stop doing that, you know?
Well, the world changes. You have to change with it. You know, I don't ride a horse to work. I don't do the bulk of my communication by telegraph. And I don't carry the same thing I carried 30 years ago.
Right. What are you carrying these days, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I've been playing lately with a pair of Glock 19s that Ben Simonson at Boresight Solutions worked over for me. I want to see just what kind of performance I can bring out of a little bit smaller pistol than I've traditionally carried. You know, I've been carrying a Glock 35 for the last 11 or 12 years. So the last couple of months I've been playing with these two 19s, and so far I'm pretty happy with them.
Yeah, Ben does. What's funny is you, myself, and Melody are all carrying Boresight guns right now. So that's what I'm going to paraphrase you and say. That's what we in police work call a clue. Is that something like that?
Yeah.
It sounds better when you say it, Tom. I don't have the chops to pull it off.
Well, and Lynn got one too, didn't she, Tom? She got a Boresight.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's been using a Boresight Glock 17 and doing quite well with it.
Yeah.
Ben's probably the very best of the plastic surgeons out there right now. he can take that basic stock Glock and make a completely different pistol out of it. I'm just tickled to death with mine.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
I love it when Tom says he's tickled to death. He says it so seriously.
Yeah, it's like I can't.
Bless your heart.
Yeah.
Oh, bless your heart.
I can't imagine you being tickled to death, but sure, okay.
you have to remember, John, we're on the radio. We're not on the range, so I have to speak a little differently than I normally do.
You do, actually, and it is quite different. So as far as like the evolution with carry ammo and stuff like that, as far as how people have, I guess, and we've only got like a minute or two left in this, in minute and a half actually, so I don't want to get too deep into this real quick, but has competition changed as well?
Oh, yeah. Back in the early 70s, you had your choice of Bullseye or PPC.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, neither one of which was terribly street relevant, in my opinion. I've shot both. PPC is basically Bullseye shooting on a silhouette. You're shooting for great precision. The X-ring on a B-27 is about the size of a pack of cigarettes, and you engage it out to 50 yards. So it's a precision game, and the time limits reflect that. When IPSC came along in the late 70s, I was involved in setting that up with Cooper. I was the original section coordinator for much of the Southeast. And that was a big step forward, and that evolved. And now it's, of course, the U.S. version of that is USPSA, but it's still part of IPSC, the International Practical Shooting Confederation.
Right.
Then later on in the 90s, they got IDPA started. I was involved with that. My IDPA number is A00008. Gives you an idea when I got in that. And we got Glock sports shooting, got Steel Challenge, got quite a few things nowadays that we didn't have as options, Bianchi Cup and so forth, that we didn't have back in the 70s, early 80s.
Well,
so you've got a lot of good opportunities here.
Well, and I was going to ask you too, but I think I'll save it for after the break, your thoughts on competition. But we got to go to break because, unfortunately, I do have to pay for the show. But we're talking with Tom Givens from Rangemaster. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. This segment brought to you by Surefire. Know your target and what is beyond it. But how can you really know your target? By shining a really bright light at it, and that's where Surefire comes in. From the new 1200 lumen EDCL 2T handheld or 500 lumen EDCL 1T handheld to the 1000 lumen XH35 or 300 lumen XC1B weapon-mounted light, Surefire can make sure you never have to yell Aziz light ever again. Now, with more lumens and improved switching, the best just got brighter. Surefire. And as a continuing offer to Ballistic Radio listeners, you can get 20% off everything at the Surefire.com web store, except batteries and suppressors, by entering the discount code Aziz light. That is AZIZLIGHT. No space. So we're talking with Tom Givens from Rangemaster, and you were sort of, before the break, going over how competition has sort of changed in the last 30 years. And I'd kind of like to settle it once and for all. There seems to be a large section of tactically minded shooters that I affectionately refer to as Timmies, and I count myself as one of them, that seem to think that competition will get you killed in the public thoroughfare. Do you have an opinion on that one way or another, Tom?
it's kind of funny. I can't find any what I would think of as qualified trainers who will tell you that you'll get killed in the streets because of competition. I don't know where this comes from, but I think it comes from people a lot further down the totem pole than you might think. Just to give you some examples, I've been involved in some kind of competition most of my life. I shot on the rifle team in high school. Shot PPC early in police career. As I said, shot IPSC back in its formative days. Shot IDPA in its formative days, including the very first IDPA match, the Invitational.
So I've been involved in some form of competitive shooting majority of my life. Clint Smith was an IPSC competitor. I met him essentially back in the 70s. Chuck Taylor was an IDPA competitor, was on the world team a couple of times, the U.S. world team a couple of times. One of the ways I met him back in the 70s. Ken Hackathorn was involved in setting up IPSC and IDPA. I think, you know, if anybody's a serious trainer about the street, quote unquote, that would be Ken. All of these guys have in common the fact that they've shot in competition and done well in it. Can you name me somebody that's of that stature in the training community who's not competed and is against competition shooting?
No, not particularly. It was kind of a loaded question that I already knew the answer to. I prefer to ask questions that I kind of have a general idea what the person I'm asking is going to say, because otherwise, and occasionally it'll happen where I ask a question and like someone will go completely opposite the direction I expected them to, and then I have nowhere to go. But yeah, no, I agree with you 1,000,000%. I can't.
Well, you must be smart.
Well, you know, I've certainly surrounded myself with very, very knowledgeable people, and I try to listen to them whenever possible.
Let's look at the good and the bad of it. What's good about competition? Okay, number one, you can build some confidence with your equipment. If you are doing well, if you're in the top 10%, so you don't have to win, you don't have to be a national champion, but you go to matches and you're consistently in the top 10% of them, then that gives your and largely, if I'm at the subconscious level, it gives your brain a feeling that, hey, I actually know what I'm doing with the gun, and that can come in pretty handy.
Right.
Match nerves. How do you get over match nerves? You go shoot matches.
Yeah.
More matches you shoot, the less match nerves become a problem. Pressure test your equipment. There's a hell of a lot of difference between a solo practice session and having performed in front of other people. And that additional stress, it seems to affect your equipment.
Yeah.
Not just the shooter. Of course, that's just a manifestation of the shooter handling things differently, but kind of jokingly say it affects your equipment, but it certainly looks that way to an observer. So if you want to find out if your holster, for instance, or your mag pouches or your pistol work well for you under some stress, then well, go shoot them under some stress.
Yeah.
And what's the simplest way to do that?
Timer.
Get up in front of your peers and perform with a timer and a published score. Those, to me, those far outweigh any negatives. Now, you want to get the most out of it, go with your actual carry gear. I won 2 state championships in IDPA with the gun I actually carried at the time and the holster I actually carried at the time with factory carry ammunition in them.
Mm-hmm.
Just so because that's how I wanted to play the game. This is the stuff I carry, so let's see what I can do with it. And there are some drawbacks, you might say, some negatives, but they can be managed very easily. Just recognize that there are some things you want to do in a match to shave hundreds here and hundreds there that you might not necessarily want to do in the real world, but I think most people are intelligent enough to tell whether they're in a match or a real fight. Right. And don't do just silly things in a match on a consistent basis and build habits. Just as an example, you've shot USPSA matches, I'm sure. You typically got a marked box on the ground from which you have to shoot. You move from this box to that box to that box, but you have to be in the box at each location to address certain targets. Saw a string of pictures the other day of various people in USPSA matches standing on one foot with that foot right at the inside edge of the box,
right,
and the other foot way up in the air so they could lean out and shoot around a barrier or something of that nature. Nobody wants to be standing on one foot in a fight and risk falling out from behind your cover or whatnot. You can take that risk in a match to save a little piece of a second because that's a cumulative problem in a match. I think the biggest distinction people need to keep in mind when they're talking about competition versus real life is that in competition, tiny increments of time make a big difference because they add up because of multiple stages. You know, if you're a half a second behind in one stage, that's not a big deal. But if you're half a second behind in 15 stages, that's 7.5 seconds at the end of the match. And
right,
that could be the difference between first place and 20th place. So don't get so carried away with that you do things like stand on one foot and lean out around barriers. But that's
just common sense more than anything else.
Yeah, and the other thing too, and this is something that's kind of funny to me as well. All the people that are capable of gaming the game are good enough shooters, because people that are new or people that frankly suck don't do it because they don't know. They're too concerned about just running a gun. So the people that actually can game the game are generally smart enough and good enough with the gun that if they weren't in the game, they wouldn't be doing it. And I think a lot of people lose sight of that.
Yeah, I agree completely. The value is not learning to do little tricks like that. The value is learning to keep your wits about you and shoot well under stress, and the competition is very good for that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I think a lot of people lose sight of that. And even just showing up says a lot about you, because I know plenty of people that don't and will not,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Absolutely. They don't want to show that they don't know. We have an awful lot of people who are real experts on the keyboard, but you get them out on the range, it's a different issue.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how that works. But and you sort of brought it up, but in competition, if you're able to sort of shake down your support gear and see what works for you and all that. But I mean, even that has advanced quite a bit in the last couple of decades, hasn't it? More than people think.
Oh yeah, yeah. Support gear has really evolved over the last 30 years, and a good bit of that can be attributed to competition, actually.
Yeah.
Competition drives innovation, and then that trickles over. You know, PPC shooters started using speed loaders long before they got them out on the street with police officers. And the same thing can be said about a lot of other equipment. Back when I started doing this, you had a leather holster or no holster.
Right.
Mostly we carried leather outside the waistband holster. Very rare seeing anybody carry IWB back in those days, and that was typically a leather summer special.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, Kydex has pretty much replaced leather. I think all of my carry stuff is Kydex. The only leather holsters I still have use are big bore revolver holsters that I use for hunting. I think all my actual practical carry gear is Kydex now. It's a big change from 30 years ago.
Well, let me ask you a question real quick, because you brought up the summer special, which, if people don't know, was designed by Bruce Nelson.
I know where this is going.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Tom. I have to. I can't stop myself from doing it. Where did Bruce originally design that holster to be carried at, Tom?
For anybody who doesn't know who Bruce Nelson is, first off, shame on you. And secondly, it's an interesting story. Bruce was a undercover narcotics agent with the California Department of Justice back in the 60s and 70s, and was a pretty busy law enforcement officer in those days. They were doing a lot of pretty dangerous work in those days. You didn't use SWAT teams. The narcs that worked cases would wind up doing the raids once they got their warrants and whatnot. And Bruce carried a 45 Commander in one of those little suede clip-on inside the waistband holsters that you see at gun shows.
Right. I'm sorry to do this. Let me interrupt real quick, and then we'll pick right back up. We have to go to break.
We're talking with
Tom Givens from Rangemaster. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Daniel Defense, the country's leading manufacturer of AR rifles and accessories. Daniel Defense, lighter, stronger, better. And before the break, I interrupted you. I'm sorry. We were talking about Bruce Nelson, and he was carrying a Commander 1911 and like a little clip-on suede holster like you'd find in the gun shows today that are garbage.
Those were pretty much what was available
for
a hide-out type holster in those days. They were made out of what my friend Farnham calls chicken hide,
mm-hmm.
and the real thin, flimsy material with that big metal clip that's supposed to come and clamp over your belt, hold the gun in your waistband. Well, Bruce was on a raid serving narcotics warrants. And gentleman stepped out with the trailer they were searching had supposedly been cleared, so he had holstered his pistol. And then this suspect stepped out of a room with a shotgun. So Bruce went for his pistol in that rig, and as they often do, it came out with the pistol. So he stand there holding a gun completely covered up by this chicken-eyed holster, which he had to furiously strip off with his sport hand.
the suspect was so amused, he just put the shotgun down laughing and surrendered at that point. But Bruce was kind of upset about that. So he went about designing the summer special, which real leather, metal reinforced band around the top so it didn't collapse when you took the gun out, and closed snap loops that went underneath the belt and back up and snapped so couldn't come out of the pants with the gun on the presentation. And, of course, most of the modern IWB holsters are some kind of, you know, might say grandchild of that original design. But Bruce carried that in the appendix position. And we're talking about back in the early 70s. A lot of people don't know that. The Summer Special was originally designed as an AIWB rig. Bruce carried it to the right of the center line, and he developed he took a lot of effort to make this a habit, developed kind of a slouch with his arms kind of hanging in front of him so that his right arm, he was right-handed, so his right arm kind of covered up the pistol so somebody bumped into him. A lot of times suspects in that drug environment will do what we call a bump search, try to see if you're a cop. They'll deliberately bump into you, see if they can feel the gun, and by having his arm hanging over the pistol there at the appendix position, he's able to avoid that, and was quite fast at ripping up the shirt with one hand, drawing the gun with the other. And we're talking about 40 years ago,
right? Well, I mean,
nothing new about that carry method at all.
Yeah, I know. I just thank you for saying it on air, though. And now it is recorded for posterity, and
it's part of public record.
Yeah. Public record.
Matter of public record.
Well, it's funny because, like, I'm a history nerd, and probably more so than most people my age. And whatever, that's, you know, it's just something I'm into. But, like, and I carry AIWB, but one of the things always, you know, the detractors always come up with, and there are reasons to be against it, but they're always like, well, it's this passing new fad. And I'm like, no, it's not. No, people have been doing it ever since there's been handguns.
Been around a very long time.
Yeah.
So. I gave it to Southnark a few years ago, but I had a IWB holster from Colt D Frame made by Chick Gaylord, who was a well-known holster maker to undercover agents and government law enforcement people one kind or another in New York back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was made for appendix carry. It was built in sometime in the early 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just been around for a while.
Well, it's like,
and he didn't come up with it either. That's just a well-made design that he came up with in the 60s.
Yeah, and you know, and Pat Rogers, when he was still alive, and we talked on a pretty regular basis, and he always said, and he stole this from somebody else, but there's no new ideas, nothing new under the sun, right? And people miss that. But anyway, moving on. Has the development of new gear and stuff like that sort of changed how we train, or has training just evolved on its own, or what's?
It has. For instance, we're seeing optics on carry guns now. Mm-hmm. Again, it's something that grew out of competition. Back in the 80s, we had USPSA shooters putting optics on their pistols. The Yankee Cup, pretty much almost have to have an optic to be in the top 10% in that game. So that's something that came about some years ago. However, those are typically frame mounted and set up fairly high in the slide, reciprocated underneath the optic without moving the optic. Changing over to slide mounted optics is a bit of a different animal. But we're seeing now optics that are small enough, light enough, rugged enough, and have enough battery life now to actually make some sense on the carry gun. We're seeing more and more of them in class. I think this past year, probably the first year that I could say we've just about every class would have at least one person with an optic in it, sometimes two or three, but we're seeing them on a pretty regular basis now. We're 10 years ago, but
right,
you never saw one, never, away from a practice range somewhere. As far as seeing them in class, it's never. And now, I'd say it's rare to have a class now that doesn't have an optic or two in it.
Yeah, I've actually started running one just because I've been having quite a hard time picking up the front sight the last little bit. Apparently, you need to be able to see the thing on top of the gun, Tom. Did you know that?
No, I'm going to look into that.
So we're coming up on the end of the show. We got a couple minutes left, and so what? for you, I guess, what has there been one thing that stuck out in your mind as like, huh, that's not how I expected all this to go, or just something you've completely sort of come full circle on or changed your opinion on? What is there one thing as an instructor that has been like, hey, this, I'm glad I changed my mind on this, or no?
You know, right off the top of my head, I can't really think of anything. To me, it's not a one big aha moment. It's just the evolution over a 40-year period of all the things we've talked about, plus all the training opportunities we have now that just didn't exist back in those days. You know, when I got started in this outside of a government law enforcement academy of some sort, there were probably a half dozen people in the country that made a living doing training.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are hundreds now,
yeah.
Plus thousands that do it, you know, as a occasional weekend side gig. But, lots and lots of people do it for a living now. So people have more training opportunities now than they've ever had, some of which actually don't suck. Back in the early days, you had to go to a well-stocked technical library or go to gun shows over and over again and scour them for old books. And nowadays, look at all the opportunities you've got just at your fingertips on the internet,
right.
Which, of course, didn't exist in those days. So there's tons of information out there. People just get up and look for it. And it's much more accessible. It's both more plentiful and more accessible now. So that's a huge change. So I think just the evolutionary process, we have more gun choices, more equipment choices, more good ammunition choices. You got more good choices in training. This is the best time in all of history for somebody who wants to learn how to take care of themselves. Now, I think that's my chief observation over the last 4 years is that things have gotten better and better and better. You've got a legal way to carry to protect yourself. You've got training opportunities to do so. You got the best equipment that's ever existed. This is the golden age of self-defense.
Well, yeah, and that's, I mean, I think, too, and this is something a lot of people miss, thank you for your work and effort in allowing that to happen. Because if it weren't for you and some other people, like you, that got started a long time ago, we wouldn't have what we have. I mean, everything sort of flows naturally from one point to another. And I think a lot of people really don't understand how few people were involved in that at a certain point. You know, so thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you again for your efforts over the years.
You're welcome. It's kind of a calling. You know, those of us that do this for a living could easily do something else. But it's to me, it's important to help good people beat bad people.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you on that. Well, thank you again for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. And I am very much looking forward to coming out and hopefully defending my second place loser title at the TACCON this year. You know,
got quite a good field this year. There are going to be quite a few talented shooters there.
Yeah,
and we're doing things a little different this year. You know, it's the 20th anniversary of the tactical conference this year.
Ooh.
So we're doing some different things this year. We've got an awful lot of trainers, and the match will be handled a little differently this year. There'll be a scored match and then a man against man shoot off.
Mm-hmm.
Among the top shooters. So that'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. That's how we did it way back in the day. That's in the early days of IPSC. The scored match was just a way to find the top 16 to go to the shoot-off.
Yeah, I'm very, very curious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see how that shakes out. We're going to have a separate shootout for the ladies. I don't guess that's a man against man. I guess that's a girl against girl. And then a man against man for the top shooters in that side of the match. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we will. I am too. Well, thanks again, Tom. Get my best to Lynn, and I hope you have a great day.
Great. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
So, make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. And hey, keep leaving those 5-star review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. It helps us out. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe. See you next week.